May it please the court, my name is Mandy Wilson and I represent the appellant Sherry Sims Bernard. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
3 minutes, yes ma'am.
In 1793, well before the Marbury versus Madison case, our Virginia Supreme Court decided Camper versus Hawkins, which stated that it is the province of the judiciary to expound the laws and to adjudge the cases that may be brought before it. Today, we're asking for a new trial for my client, the mother, because to this date, despite all these many years, a court has never adjudicated her cause. Additionally, we're asking for the court to limit guardian ad litem fees to $158 as the statutory maximum, pursuant to Virginia Code Section 16.1-267 and Virginia Code Section 19.2-163.
Wasn't there an agreement to this, or
not the agreement, the understanding, if I recall correctly, was that if a guardian ad litem is to be appointed, then this is the person who should be appointed and the fees were known at that time?
No, Your Honor. I've worked with Mr. Patton in other cases, so I was familiar with his work, and I recommended to the court, I objected to a guardian ad litem, period, but I did recommend, because I, based on my knowledge of him, that he be used. The other cases I've been involved with did not involve those sorts of fees. So he did send me an email at some point after I had made that recommendation to the court asking if these fees were okay, and I did object at that point, and I believe he concedes to that in his brief and states in his brief that, yes, indeed, I said, I'm sorry, my client just can't simply afford that.
Am I right that you, as I recall, you said to him, I certainly don't doubt you're worth that much, but my client can't afford that. So your objection was pretty much directed toward him, but was not brought to the court until the end, court's attention until the end of the case?
Well, the fee just was not discussed. And, you know, I believe you used to be a JNDR judge. You know all the time that guardian ad litem come across, the clients are indigent, the court hears, makes a hearing, makes a finding that it's indigent or whatever else, or that the parties can't pay, and that's when the court makes the determination of the fees
but
at the end.
But the circuit court can't do that, make the determination that the state will absorb the cost of the guardian fees. Is that your understanding as well?
Well, no, I don't believe that's true at all. In fact, the statute, 16.1-267, very clearly states in all other cases it shall be as determined by 19.2-163. And 19, all other cases is all other cases. So that's circuit court cases, that's JNDR cases. The only other viable argument that could possibly be made is, gosh, if he's not appointed under 16.1-266, there's no other statute that allows for guardian ad litem to be appointed, and so his whole appointment would be void ab initio. But he was appointed under 16.1-266F in this particular case. The guardian ad litem concedes that in his brief that that's what occurred. I think we're now relegated to the mandate that's issued under 16.1-267 that in all other cases, its guardian ad litem fees are as 19.2-163. And it's pretty clear that under 19.2-163 that there's some statutory caps. Now, granted, the actual language of 19.1-163 says specifically to indigent, criminal indigents. But that's an absurd result because that would make it impossible for us to follow 16.1-267's mandate that all compensation shall be by 19.2-163. So I think we have to harmonize those statutes so that we can give the best reading to both of the statutes pursuant to statutory construction rules. And we have to say, well, it's not just limited to criminal defense indigents. It's limited to court-appointed counsel. And in court-appointed counsel, then clearly the statutory caps is $158 in circuit court and $120 in district court. This was a circuit court case.
That's criminal cases.
again, that's the only schedule provided.
And you're asking us to expand that to also include in guardian cases.
Well, and I don't think it's only criminal cases, because if you look at the Virginia Supreme Court Chart of Allowances, because 19.2-163 also says refer to the Virginia Supreme Court Chart of Allowances. If you look at that Virginia Chart of Allowances, then it very specifically says in two places, one under 19.2-163, that this pertains to guardian ad litem in civil court. It says 75 per hour and 55, 75 per hour in court costs, 55 per hour out of court costs. And also, if you look at another part, which I cited in my brief, of the Virginia Chart of Allowances, it also goes and it says guardian ad litem are limited to $158 statutory cap and in circuit court and $120 in district court, because the statute says that pursuant to that it can be compensated pursuant to 19.2-163. So I did cite that part of the Virginia Supreme Court Chart of Allowances in my brief. So I think it makes it very clear that they are applying it to guardian ad litem. Additionally, I think the other part of our argument is that we believe that the current order from October 2012 is void ab initio. And the reason that we think that is because this court's already decided that third parties cannot determine custody and visitation.
In those cases, did we say that the prior order was void or simply reverse and remand for further proceedings consistent with that order?
Void. They were void. At that point in time, both of those cases were coming up on their original appeal. And while I certainly argued, I was the attorney in both those cases, but I certainly argued that the cases were void ab initio in, I guess, maybe the most recent case I did before the court, Higgins versus Pierce. I don't think the court had to reach that issue in those cases because the it was the current case log. In this particular case, we're asking the court to reach that issue if it's void ab initio.
Was that issue raised in the direct appeal that occurred in 2013?
Void ab initio was not raised. The issue of whether it was void was raised in that appeal, but the court considered it waived because the argument was not fully fleshed out and made.
If the voidness argument was made, and I know voidness can be raised at any time, but isn't there an exception to that rule that once you've raised it once and lost, that it's lost forever? Or you could, obviously, the litigation could have written. You could just keep asserting that it was void and do it a million times. And so if you raised voidness in the 2013 appeal and it was decided against Ms. Simms-Bernard in 2013 for whatever reason, isn't it over?
No. And I believe what you're referring to is the Carruthers versus Hera case. And the reason it's not over is, one, the facts aren't the same in this case, because the facts are now that the third party that was given the decision to make the custody and visitation decision has closed its case in 2014 and said, we're done.
But that would not be, I mean, it seems to me that the exception to the prior judgment there would be we have a significant change in circumstances that you could raise that. Mm-hmm. But the question of whether something is void, mm-hmm. once you've litigated whether it's void or not, if you lose whether it's void, then that becomes the decision, and you can't then just say the voidness exception gets me back in every time, or you would never have a finality to a decision of it's void. If you raised it was void in 2013 and lose that issue, then I don't think you can raise it again in 2017 and say it's void.
Well, I disagree, because I believe that under case law, it can be raised at any time and at any issue under the Amin case. But
we're right, but in Amin, it was raised one time. Mm-hmm. It was raised for the first time, and it was resolved in Mr. Amin's favor. Mm-hmm. But if Mr. Amin had raised it, litigated it, and lost, mm-hmm. could he raise it again?
Well, I think that the Virginia Supreme Court has kind of overruled that Carruthers case in the Graf-Mueller versus Commonwealth case. As you know, in Graf-Mueller versus Commonwealth in 2010, this court decided Mr. Graf-Mueller appealed. He said, my sentencing is wrong. Court of Appeals said, no, your sentencing is right, and affirmed his conviction in 2010.
But he didn't litigate the voidness question.
He litigated the sentencing issue. And Rawls versus Commonwealth was subsequently decided, and then in 2015, Graf-Miller came back to the Virginia Supreme Court and said, hey, we've done this, so therefore I want to go back and relitigate this. I think this is void ab initio. And the Supreme Court agreed with him, even though he had already litigated the issue at the Court of Appeals and lost in 2010.
But that's, if I understand the way that was litigated, it's a little different than the question I asked you. Mm-hmm. If you raised in, and you said you raised in the appeal the voidness issue, maybe not using the phrase void ab initio, but you raised the voidness issue. Once the voidness issue is litigated and the decision is reached on it, doesn't that end any claim that something is void?
Well, in this particular case, it was waived. So the court never reached a decision that it was or it wasn't, the proper decision.
Well, right, but the issue itself was litigated in that appeal. I mean, it was raised in that appeal and decided, granted on procedural grounds, adverse to you. Doesn't that resolve whether the order is void or not?
No, it doesn't.
Why not?
Well, look at Evans versus Smythe with Airport Commission. And if you look at that case, then what happens is they have a consent order in 1984 that the Airport Commission is going to give up its rights to eminent domain. It's affirmed with the circuit court. They do not appeal it at all. Then it comes back in the 90s. The circuit court judge overturns the order, the consent order, and says it's void ab initio. And the reason that they say that that is void ab initio is because the Airport Commission cannot give up its inherent authority to make its powers eminent domain powers. Then it goes up to the Virginia Supreme Court. The Virginia Supreme Court says, yes, that order is void ab initio from 1984, even though it was litigated and it was not appealed.
But now, the voidness issue wasn't litigated. I mean, that's my question. Once the voidness issue, I agree that you can raise voidness at any time.
Mm-hmm.
But once you raise it, and you raise it once, and you litigate it, if you lose, then you can't. Then that's the exception to the anytime. You can't continually raise it going on into the future because it's already been litigated and resolved that it's not void.
Well, I just...
Even if that's mistaken, mm-hmm. if it was raised, litigated, and you lost, isn't that a bar to raising it in the future?
No. And look at the logic. What you're saying is in circuit court, hey, if you don't appeal it, you don't do anything with it, then you can go to Virginia or the Court of Appeals, and if they said it was void, then you can't raise it again. Well, now under your logic, I can't raise it here because it was already raised, and I was not the attorney at that time.
I just want to point out that you're in your rebuttal time, which is okay, but I just want to make sure you're mindful.
Thank you, Your Honor. So under your logic, then we could go to the Court of Appeals, and I was not the attorney in the original Court of Appeals case, but then I can go to the Virginia Supreme Court, and now I don't have an issue because it hasn't ever been raised in that court. Likewise, that's what happened in Evans versus Smythe Airport Commission, is because in the trial court it was raised, but it wasn't raised at the Court of Appeal. So I think that it doesn't really make a difference because I think if it's void ab initio, it can be raised at any time.
And so even if you litigate it in a court, take it all the way up, all the chain of appeal, and the court says it's not a void order,
mm-hmm.
right? The next day you can file the exact same suit and allege it's void again and start it all over again. And if they rule against you again, you could start it over the very next day all over again there. As long as you put in the pleading that the underlying order is void, you are never barred from pursuing that. That just doesn't seem to me that can be right.
Well, there's a difference in a void, and I think we're confusing because I'm talking void ab initio, and void ab initio are slightly different things, and sometimes the words are used interchangeably, which makes it confusing. In the Carruthers case, which I think is the case you're referring to, the case was, it was an issue of void. He said he wasn't properly served. And the trial court found that he was properly served. So it was a factual issue that was being decided, not a legal issue. This is a legal issue, which this court has never decided eventually, but did not decide in this case. So it was not reached. And so I think the difference that you and I are talking about is a factual determination, which I don't think could be raised again, which is what occurred in the Carruthers case, versus a legal determination, which is what happened in this case, which this court never reached that determination because of waiver issues. I'm going to save my 23 seconds of rebuttal time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Padden?
May it please the court, my name is Chase Padden. I'm a guardian ad litem for Kendall Bernard. I was formerly a guardian ad litem for Kelly Bernard, but she, her case was dismissed and was moved because she became an adult. I agree with the position that I believe Judge Russell has at least put forward, that the issue was heard. Ms. Simpson-Bernard appealed it. She lost on that appeal, and she should not be allowed to continually reappeal that issue.
And do you agree that it wasn't just that she said that the order was wrong in some way, that the actual issue that it was void was litigated in the 2013 appeal?
I don't believe she used the word void, but I believe she used the reasons that she's now saying it's void. She used those exact same reasons that the judiciary can't give up its decision-making power. It's the same. It's exactly the same basis. So she's here for the same reason. It's just under a slightly different name. I do think if it were determined to be void ab initio, it could be raised at any time. That doesn't mean repeatedly. It means it could be raised. She raised it. She lost. I think that's done. I think that she's been heard on that. She had her day, and she lost on that. Additionally, on that issue, the cases cited by Ms. Wilson don't establish that it void ab initio. It establishes that the court was there in error, I would take the same position that the court perhaps was in error when it made that ruling back in 2012, but she appealed it, she lost, and so it's of no moment at this juncture. Furthermore, in its 2012 order, the trial court did retain jurisdiction over the issue until subsequent order of that same court. There was the potential for review and modification. Mother has now sought that exact remedy. She has always had a remedy. She could file a motion to amend. She filed a motion to amend. And that's what was before the trial court.
Do you agree that the initial order delegated the custody determination, the visitation schedule, to someone other than the court?
I do not agree that it delegated the custody. It didn't.
Okay.
I do agree that it delegated a portion of it. Delegated the schedule making. It absolutely did. It did say it's going to be supervised. I think so. There was a ruling on that issue, and then it gave the schedule alone.
And under our current case law, that's an error.
It is an error. Yes.
Okay.
On that same issue, I would go and say that the trial court never ruled that there was not a change in circumstances in this matter. Even if Ms. Wilson, if Ms. Simpson-Bernard is correct, mother, the provision is the only thing that would be void ab initio in this case. It would be the only thing that could be struck from that order. We'd still be left with what was there. And if it comes back to the trial court is still going to have the right to order an independent psychological evaluation. So mother's going to have all the same problems that she has when we were just before the court then. I also agree with Judge Russell on the fact that the position that mother is currently taking would disrupt the finality of many, many, many orders that are years, if not many years old, and that wouldn't serve the children and the Commonwealth well. It wouldn't serve the litigants well to undo that, and I think it would open the door to lots of litigation that wouldn't benefit anyone.
Tell me about the authority for your guardian ad litem fees and the court's distribution of those fees.
Yes, ma'am. The trial court clearly had the authority to appoint a guardian ad litem under the Verrocchio, I'm not exactly sure how you say it, but under that case, it had the authority to appoint a guardian, and it clearly had the authority to apportion its fees. There's nothing in that case or in subsequent case law that indicates that there's a cap. Certainly, there's no indication that there's a cap of $158, as mother claims. The fact that in juvenile cases, there's a $75 for in-court and $55 for out-of-court fee, that's true. I've served in juvenile courts many, many times and been paid through OES. But it seems to me that it's a bit nonsensical to think then that there's a $158 cap. It doesn't suggest, in most custody cases, you're doing your job right. You're going to spend more than 1 or 2 hours doing them. You're going to spend a lot more than that in a contentious case. And if the cap were $158, it would make a lot more sense just to make that a flat fee or proceed in a different fashion.
When was any problem with your fee first raised with the trial court? How far after your appointment?
To be candid with the court, I think a question that was asked earlier was a little bit off on the facts. I approached counsel, both counsel, for the parties about my fee to see if they objected. Counsel for father did not object. Counsel for mother, Ms. Wilson, didn't object to the value of the fee, didn't say there's a statutory cap, what are you talking about, didn't say there's these limits prescribed by statute, what are you talking about, it's 75, 55, and you get 158, none of that happened. She did absolutely tell me at that time, my client can't afford it. In her email, which I believe I cited to in my brief, she said if it was $50, I would have to object. So I think she certainly told me that she objected to...
But she never told the court.
My question is...
When did she
to be fair, I don't think the court knew at that time either. I hadn't sort of told the court what I was going to charge. I didn't submit my bill or do any of those things, my motion, until the case had concluded.
And when the case was concluded, you submitted your bill to the court, and at that time the objections were filed, and then the court...
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am, absolutely. The court reviewed it. I had... my itemized time there, I would point out to the court, I think it's obvious from the record, but I mean, it was extensively litigated. There may not have been much evidence presented, but there was a long history that predated my involvement. I obviously had to meet with the children. I met with the parents. I talked to counsel. There was many motions filed. There was many interesting arguments made that took me a lot to research. I certainly tried to do my best, and I felt like my time was warranted in the case. I'm not aware of any authority that limits it to the 75, 55, or that limits it to the $158 cap, or any other number. Mother's contention that she was denied her constitutional right to a prompt trial, she simply wasn't, and that's not what happened. The court gave her a hearing, I think within 2 months, maybe less, of her filing her initial motion. The court determined that it needed an independent psychological evaluation, set out to do that. That was complicated by the fact that I think Ms. Wilson had some conflicts with various people in the Richmond metropolitan area. The court set about, I thought, a reasonable course of action to find people in other places. There was a lot of effort expended on my part, her part, opposing counsel's part, to find those people for a variety of reasons that are made clear in the record. That didn't happen. The court continued to determine that it was necessary. Ms. Wilson on behalf of mother conceded that a mental health evaluation needed to be done, but she wanted to provide her own. She didn't want it to be independent. I believe now is as the children's guardian ad litem that an independent mental health examination was necessary. As Ms. Wilson referenced, I think in a footnote in one of her briefs, I mean, attorneys do sometimes look for somebody who will support their position, who's known to or who they believe will, and I think that the whole point of 20-124.2 is to work around that. And if this court or another court were to permit litigants in mother's position to make that difficult and then prevent that from happening, then it would undermine the statute. And more importantly, I think it would be dangerous for the children that are involved. And then I would just point out to the court that I move for my fees and cost in pursuing this appeal. I believe, as the trial court did, that the case was driven mostly by mother trying to make an end run around the independent mental health examination. She vigorously pursued her case, which is certainly her right to do, but that meant as the children's advocate, I had to do the same. And I would point out to the court that the sole child remaining in this case turns 18 in February. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
your remaining seconds.
Your Honor, just to touch very briefly on the voidness issue again, I think that when it came back before the court on a reinstatement, and the court is made aware that we've got a third party who quit and who's not willing to determine visitation any longer, we've now got a material change of circumstance allowing mother to raise this issue again. And at that point, the court should have said, hey, you're right, third parties can't make a visitation. I'm going to make a temporary visitation decision, whatever that is, because I cannot abdicate my responsibility to make that decision.
Well, did the court abdicate its responsibility or said, I can't make a... I think, given all these circumstances, I'm willing to address visitation, but I need an independent mental health examination to do my to exercise the duty that the statutes give me. That's what I need.
I see my time's up. Would you like me to answer the question?
Yes, I would.
The bottom line is that the court could have made whatever decision it wanted, even if the decision was dad gets sole custody, sole visitation, mom gets no visitation. And so it should have made some sort of decision, whatever that decision was, as soon as it became aware that it's now back before the court, so that it did not continue to abdicate its responsibility to determine that custody and visitation. The fact that the court went 19 more months and never made that adjudication, which was its responsibility and power to do, then that's where it became a problem, and it should have done that. Thank you very much.
Very well, thank you. We will come down and greet counsel, and thereafter take up the case of Commonwealth versus Barry.